This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Show a majority of people in Scotland and Northern Ireland favour breakup of the UK. This as the Scottish Nationalists announced plans for a new independence referendum. France imposes new border controls for travellers from EU countries as part of efforts to stem the spread of the coronavirus. A U.S. aircraft carrier group enters the South China Sea hours after Washington reaffirms its support for Taiwan in the row with China. It's good to have you with us. Top story, new polls indicating a majority of people in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales are seeking independence from Britain. Surveys also indicated that the sense of British identity is disintegrating. The Scottish National Party has announced it will hold a second independence referendum in case British Prime Minister Boris Johnson refuses to allow one. Scotland held a referendum in 2014 in which more than 55% of voters said no to secession from the UK. Well, I talked to one of our correspondents in London, Robert Carter, and he said that the UK's departure from the EU has been a major cause behind the growing calls for independence.
Well, each country within the UK is seeing a rise in anti-union sentiment, and they, of course, they all have their own independent reasons for feeling in such a way. Scotland, of course, is unique in the sense that it has had a very large pro-independence movement for quite some time. And obviously, I'm sure you all remember the referendum of 2014, which the independence movement lost very narrowly. It was about 55% pro-union, which just about won out compared to about 45%. So obviously, it was a very close tie. But what's changed since then is obviously Brexit, and of course Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union. So what the Scottish Nationalist Party is arguing is that the circumstances have changed so dramatically that of course it's warranted another referendum, but Westminster of course doesn't want to give them the chance to do so.
France has enforced new border controls as part of a massive effort to contain the spread of COVID-19 and avoid another national lockdown. High new rates for infections, hospitalizations, and COVID deaths have fueled fears that France may need another full lockdown, which would be the third. Such a lockdown would inflict yet more devastation on businesses and daily lives. As of Sunday, arrivals to France from European Union countries by air and sea need to produce a negative PCR test result obtained in the previous 72 hours. EU travelers entering France by land, including cross-border workers, won't need a negative test. Some 62,000 people currently arrive in France airports and seaports from other EU countries every week. People in Portugal are heading for the polls to cast their ballots in the presidential election, which incumbent Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa has been tipped to win. 11 million people are eligible to vote, although pollsters expect record high abstentions due to the COVID pandemic. Most opinion polls put Rebelo de Sousa far ahead of his challengers, socialist Ana Gomes, and far-right populist André Ventura. Low turnout could upset the expected easy win for him, though. In his final campaign speech, de Sousa said that the people should not allow the election to stretch out, urging them to turn out in large numbers to back and win another term and avoid a runoff. Portugal has recorded a steep rise in infections and deaths over the past couple of days, overall tally reaching 600,000 cases and 10,000 related deaths. The United States has reaffirmed its commitment to deepening ties with Taiwan amid rising tensions between the self-ruled island and China. The U.S. State Department says Washington will continue to help Taipei maintain sufficient self-defense capability. Spokesman Ned Price also urged China to stop pressuring Taiwan and instead engage in meaningful dialogue with the officials. Meantime, the U.S. military says an aircraft carrier group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt has entered the South China Sea. And that after Taiwan reported an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone, Beijing is critical of Washington's boosting ties with the island, which it views as part of its territory. Political analyst Einar Tengen says that the Biden administration seems to have adopted the stance of its predecessor on China.
It's an extremely dangerous situation. What you have is the Biden administration reaffirmed basically the stance that Donald Trump has towards China, which is to, in essence, provoke it with a series of trade and other measures. But they said that they would be adopting different tactics. Unfortunately, their support for Taiwan that was voiced during the confirmation hearings make it very clear that they do not intend to abide by the letter of the One China policy, and this is extremely volatile. These nations could be sleepwalking into war. China, for its part, responded by sending airplanes into space that Taiwan claims for its own. And this is the kind of escalation that everyone has been looking to avoid.
The Venezuelan president says that he's willing to turn a page with the U.S. under President Biden after years of tensions with the previous administration. Nicolas Maduro called for a new path in his country's relations with Washington based on mutual respect, dialogue, and understanding. The Trump administration had slapped numerous rounds of sanctions on Venezuela, including an oil embargo in 2019, to overthrow the Maduro government. Caracas broke diplomatic ties with Washington in 2019 when the U.S. government recognized opposition leader Juan Guaido as the country's interim president. The new U.S. administration says it has started reviewing a controversial decision by the former administration to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist group. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed the latest developments with our guests.
The U.S. State Department says it has started to review the terrorist designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement days after the inauguration of Joe Biden as the new U.S. president. The department said it is working as fast as possible to conduct the review and make a determination. That is while former U.S. President Donald Trump blacklisted the Ansarullah as a terrorist group in the final days of his administration. The move triggered protests from the U.N. and international aid groups as well as the Yemeni people. UN officials believe that the act would further complicate efforts to combat the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN fears that the designation will discourage foreign businesses from helping the war-torn nation. The humanitarian situation in the country has worsened due to years of Saudi-led war and blockade. Hussein Abu-Khati is a Yemeni activist and political commentator joining us from Sana'a. We have Saad Shahabi, who's a political analyst and Middle East expert, joining us from London. Welcome to you both, Hussein Abu-Khati. Your reaction to this piece of news?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To be honest with you, I think this kind of statement is just for media consumption. I don't think that Joe Biden will, his government will remove Ansarullah the Houthi from the so-called designated terrorist list. Neither will he stop the sales of weapons toward Saudi Arabia. Biden is, they are calling him or naming him in the United States as the shadow of Obama or Obama shadow. And this war has actually started during Obama administration, and the largest deals for weapon sales have been during as well Obama administration. That's why I don't think, because the United States foreign policy, security policy is one, despite the fact either is Trump as president or now Biden, and in the coming days, in the coming weeks, we will see that none of the promises that was made by Biden will be made, as example, to stop the war on Yemen, or at least to stop the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and as well the case about the killing of the journalist Khashoggi. So in the coming weeks and days, we will see, because the blockade that's enforced on Yemen, the United States and Saudi Arabia, they are behind that blockade that have killed more than 300,000 Yemenis. Just imagine, if they are not allowing food and medicine to come to Yemen, they are not allowing fuel ship to enter Yemen, Hodeidah port, even though after they are searched by Saudi Arabia, United Nations and United States, I don't think that Biden actually will do anything towards Yemen either, to take Houthis from the labeling as terrorist group. But both ways, here in Sana'a, they believe that the war is the United States is fully behind this war. So for them here in Sana'a, it will not matter if they stay on the list or not, because the war still continue and the blockade has not stopped from the beginning of this war.
Well, Sasha Habi, the news says that this new U.S. administration is going to review the terrorist labeling of the Nasrallah fighters. And that's due to humanitarian crisis that's happening, that it would complicate matters. If they are sincere, and if the U.S. President Joe Biden is sincere, why doesn't he say to Saudi Arabia, stop the war, stop bombing Yemen, and let humanitarian supplies get into the country while we review this terrorist designation? Because that's another obstacle, is when a war is going on, which is, the Saudi Arabia is leading in its air campaign, is stopping aid from being distributed. Just one example.
Thank you very much, and welcome to you and to our guest, our friend Hussein Rukhaiti. And of course, our salute goes to the people of Yemen, who have been able to withstand all the crimes that have been committed by the Saudi Emirati Khalifi American invasion. Now, Yemen will remain the barometer of the Biden presidency. This is the first important, most important issue, I think, today, because there are more than 30 million lives at stake there. The worst humanitarian crisis in modern times. People are dying, children are dying, and so on and so forth. And this is all committed by the Saudis and the Emiratis, of course, supported by both the America and the British experts on the ground. Now, if Biden is not going to take serious action to stop the war, to remove Ansarullah from the list of terrorism, then I think probably the whole world will become angry and will become disappointed that they put a lot of expectations on this Democrat president. And if he doesn't do that, then what else should he start with? This is the most important issue. He should declare immediately, without any further delay, that the U.S. is withdrawing from Yemen, that it is stopping supplies of weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis and Khalifis of Bahrain, and that it is going to remove Ansarullah or any hint of putting them on the list of terrorism, because the whole world, even Mr. Guterres himself, the United Nations Security General, as well as other aid groups, are saying that unless Ansarullah is removed from that list, then we will not be able to carry out our duties.
Thank you very much for that. Hussein Abulqaiti, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Sasha Abi, thank you. Political analyst and Middle East expert there from London. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. Let's move on. The United Nations Refugee Agency is expressing concerns about a resurgence of violence in Sudan's Darfur region, which has caused a fresh flow of refugees to neighboring Chad. The UNHCR says the tribal clashes have killed at least 250 people and displaced 100,000 others. Some 3,500 of the refugees, most of them women and children, have fled to Chad, where they're sheltering under the trees without access to basic services. The fighting in Darfur has already spread to the western and southern parts of the region. The violence is a major test for the Sudanese government following the withdrawal of the UN and the African Union peacekeepers from the region earlier this month. An Islamic human rights NGO has urged Nigeria to release the country's leading Muslim cleric and his wife, who've been unlawfully detained since 2015. Special Nader Sheikh's wife has been diagnosed with COVID-19. Our correspondent Najuma Abdullahi has more.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around even sharing, distributing contacts, that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them. They will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Mala Mazina, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the corpse, as court has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now, his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that brings us to the end of this news broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Europeans' empty promises after the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The Europeans didn't do anything. Their last miracle was a stupid game called Instex, which has not become operational yet. It has not been put in place yet. In sum, Instex means that Iran should give to their European excellencies, for example, to the French and the English, the money that the others owe to us so that they will buy every product that they deem good and send it to Iran. This is what Instex means. This is a wrong measure in itself, but they have not fulfilled this very promise either. The cure for sanctions is to activate domestic capacities. Of course, this requires hard work and diligence. We should work hard. This is another point.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
I wish to say something about the economic issues of the country. Well, the country has certain problems in terms of people's livelihood issues. Families really have serious livelihood problems. Prices are high, and this should be remedied. Of course, I have spoken to officials in private meetings, or I have sent them messages about the things that should be done. I have spoken to Mr. President, and I have also sent messages to other officials so that they will do certain things. However, I wish to stress again that the organizations in charge should pay attention to this point. In the area of economic problems, certain issues are urgent, and certain issues require long-term and mid-term measures.
Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Donald Trump has become the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice following the riots at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. He has also been banned by Twitter and deplatformed by almost every social media site. Democrats and incoming President Joe Biden celebrated the move and are calling for new anti-terror laws to be implemented with a lot of similar rhetoric we've heard before. Some speculate that we're entering a new domestic war on terror. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. After months of Donald Trump saying the election was stolen from him in favor of Joe Biden and disputing the results endlessly on social media, his supporters held a Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C. as the Electoral College was taking place to formally declare Biden the winner. We saw videos of people fighting with police, smashing in windows, and struggling to overcome security in order to get inside the Capitol building and disrupt the process. Weirdly enough, for what is supposedly one of the most secure buildings on Earth, there was no police response anywhere near as violent or repressive as we saw last summer against the Black Lives Matter protesters following the death of George Floyd. Interestingly enough, we saw other videos of people at the Capitol just being let inside as barriers were lifted and doors were opened, ushering in scores of disgruntled MAGA hat-wearing protesters, some bearing arms and Confederate flags. Following these events, Donald Trump simply told people to just go home and that he loved them, and continued to post on Twitter that the election was stolen from him, and this ultimately led to him being permanently banned by the platform that he infamously used as his main podium and soapbox during these last years. What's interesting to note here is the double standard that Twitter seems to employ in regards to how it handled the situation. At first, during the last couple of months, social media sites decided to place warnings under Donald Trump's tweets and posts because he was disputing the results of the election, alleging it had been stolen from him. Many of his supporters across the country began echoing these same claims and holding protests in response. In the lead-up to the Capitol riots, Trump announced there would be a big protest in D.C., calling on his supporters to be there and be wild. After the riots took place, Twitter banned Trump's account, but not for that particular tweet, for different ones, which Twitter outlined in their reasoning. They cited two tweets by Trump, one saying that people who voted for him had been treated disrespectfully and unfairly, all 75 million of them, and another tweet announcing that he would not be attending the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Twitter said that these tweets violated their glorification of violence policy. Now, that's a very interesting thing because Donald Trump has been president now for almost 4 years, and on Twitter much longer than that. He came on Twitter and confessed to the murder of General Qasem Soleimani, and he was very proud of it too. He also threatened to bomb Iran on several occasions, making direct threats to the president and even threatening to bomb Iran's cultural sites. He also threatened other nations like Russia, Syria, and Turkey directly on the same platform. These are barbaric, primitive acts. This is not just glorifying violence, it's threatening violence, which also goes against Twitter's rules and the rules of many other sites and platforms, and it's not something that is considered free speech usually to threaten violence in most supposed liberal democracies. Yet, nonetheless, Trump was allowed to do so for years. No one stopped him. Where were these same arbiters? Where was the same outrage at Trump's behavior when he was glorifying bombing and sanctioning other countries? Why do they only care once it happens at home, but never abroad? There is also the concern and broader implications of what it means for a sitting U.S. president to be deplatformed by all these big tech companies in Silicon Valley and for them to decide what constitutes permissible speech. This isn't just to do with Trump, but also to do with freedom of expression, the ability of journalists to do their jobs, for us to know what heads of state are saying, and also whether these websites are platforms or publishers, because it seems they want to have their cake and eat it too. Now, yes, while some think it's perhaps a great thing that we don't have to hear from Trump anymore and we can all celebrate that he's gone, it's also very worrying to think what these same tech companies might do in the future to others who disagree with them and have done in the past. We've seen Twitter, Facebook, and Google do this to leftist, anti-imperialist, and other adversarial voices on several occasions. Press TV just recently had its Google and YouTube accounts shut down. We've seen the Venezuelan-based Telesur also purged from Facebook in the past, not to mention many other independent or dissenting voices who oppose the wars and the American political establishment. So if you think this is only going to happen to people on the right or only to fascists, think again, because you're sorely mistaken. Another argument being made, astonishingly, by people on the supposed left is that, well, Twitter and others are private companies, so it's well within their rights to get rid of Trump. First of all, I never thought I'd hear people on the left arguing in favor of corporations doing whatever they like, irrespective of the broader implications that this might have on public discourse. After all, whether we like it or not, in the 21st century, the main arena of public discourse is predominantly the internet and takes place online. So to merely chalk this up as a corporation making a business decision is disingenuous. However, to those who think that these big tech companies are just private entities operating in Silicon Valley, I'd like to offer them a stark reminder. Back in 2009, when there were protests in Iran disputing the results of the presidential election, Twitter was being used to coordinate them. The U.S. State Department realized this and even reached out to Twitter, asking them not to undergo scheduled maintenance of their website, just for the sake of keeping those protests in Iran going. If Twitter is acting at the behest of foreign policy decision makers in Washington, D.C., then it's no longer just a private company. Also, note the irony that when people in the United States dispute election results, they put labels on their tweets and deplatform them. But when you do it in Iran, Twitter has no problem and will even take a break from fixing its own website just for the sake of keeping the civil unrest going. The same goes for the so-called Arab Spring, where social media sites like Facebook and Twitter carried the movement. These platforms were the primary vehicle through which protests, dissent, and information were organized and disseminated in order to bring about revolution. Twitter and others never stepped in to stop any of this. They encouraged it. And this shows that there is a clear double standard and glaring hypocrisy on their part. Not to mention that in 2013, through the revelations of whistleblower Edward Snowden, we now know that the National Security Agency, the NSA, was working with big tech companies like Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and many more in order to collect information on everyone in bulk and spy on their communications and activities online in what was called the PRISM program. So once again, to say that these companies are private, when they have demonstrated many times in the past that they not only cooperate, but carry out the agenda of the US government and its national security state, is delusional. Clearly, they're okay with revolt, insurrection, and civil unrest when it happens in Arab countries or in Iran or abroad, and will even help ferment those movements. However, once it happens at home and doesn't suit their friends in the national security blob or the Democratic Party, then they will step in to put an end to it. Notice once again the hypocrisy of how a majority of the politicians in Washington, including Trump, had no problem supporting the fascist coup in Bolivia led by white supremacist groups who overthrew Evo Morales, destroying his home, trashing his sister's home and those of other government officials. People were killed there too. The U.S. government had no problem supporting a coup in Venezuela either, with Silver Core or picking the puppet Juan Guaido and ridiculously dubbing him interim president. The United States had no problem sponsoring and supporting Daesh inside of Syria in order to overthrow the government. They had no problem supporting the Contras in Nicaragua or secret CIA projects like the Phoenix program in Vietnam. The United States has supported countless coups in other countries, helping to overthrow governments and leaders of other nations. The United States and its empire are the vehicle through which white supremacy is disseminated globally. They march their armies into other lands, subjugating people of color, killing them, and stealing their resources. And ironically, all these wars and conflicts are exported from that very same building, the Capitol. So if U.S. politicians are really horrified at what took place, maybe they shouldn't do it to others. Now, beyond the hypocrisy of the regime in D.C., it's important to note the fallout of the riots that transpired at the Capitol and what policy measures are being taken next. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer gave a speech comparing the riots to Pearl Harbor. The incoming president, Joe Biden, said that his top priority will be to pass a domestic terror law. In the media itself, we saw the New York Times begin to float the idea of the Sedition Act, an archaic law from the First World War, and prior, which was used to euthanize the First Amendment and jail anyone who criticizes the government during wartime. We also saw a recent report about how the FBI knew there would be violence taking place at the Capitol, but didn't do anything about it out of fear they would violate the First Amendment. Now, this is, of course, a story that is written to condition people into thinking that in order for you to be kept safe, you have to give up your rights. It's the exact same logic that was used in the wake of 9/11. The same fear-mongering and scare tactics in order to acquiesce people into believing and accepting that they would be more safe if they gave up some of their civil liberties. This is exactly how things like the war on terror were sold to the general public, how the imperialist wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were accepted as some kind of necessity, and also how the mass surveillance programs were born and led to things like the Patriot Act, and why some are worried that a new Patriot Act might be on the way. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me to talk more is journalist Whitney Webb, writer and researcher for Unlimited Hangout. Thanks for coming on the show, Whitney. Good to have you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
We've seen a lot of Democrats using what I simply call neocon or neoconservative language after what happened at the Capitol, saying things like, our democracy is under attack, you're either with us or against us, very similar to George Bush and his cronies. And so there's a lot of sentiment now going around that what happened at the Capitol is going to be used to usher in a new age of the war on terror and pass all these authoritarian laws in order to trample on civil liberties and freedom of speech. How do you see this playing out right now in the immediate future with Biden taking over and also in the long term?
Okay, well, in the short term, I think we're already seeing, right, the reintroduction of legislation that has been introduced really over the past 2 years about domestic terror, but they're mainly focused on preventing domestic terror events before they happen, which is basically a pivot and a push towards pre-crime, which obviously is going to be very surveillance heavy. As far as January 6th goes, I have been calling that really the opening act for this war on domestic terror, because the type of systems they want to implement, they haven't manufactured enough consent for that, and so they require more events, maybe in the same style as January 6th, or maybe something even more intense and severe that causes a greater loss of life and things like that going forward in order to introduce this stuff. And as far as the Democrats parroting neocon talking points, really after the 2016 election, we saw neocons being brought into the resistance fold, people like Bill Kristol, for example, but also sort of this joining of the DNC with, you know, Romney-style Republicans who were basically neocons coming together to form what I really call the Uniparty. And now after January 6th, you know, the mask of that has really come off, and we're seeing that wing of the Republicans joining with the Democrats, and they will be putting through a lot of this nightmare legislation, particularly as you have the Biden administration with a majority of their party in both houses of Congress. So in the short term, it's definitely disconcerting. In the long term, that's really up to the people if they're really going to go along with this. And it's very interesting that we're seeing this being sold more to anyone else than to progressives, really. And that's why I think we're having like the Squad playing such a central role in trying to sell this to their base in particular. But really what this is divide and conquer on a massive scale, and how this plays out in the long term depends on how long that continues to be successful for.
So I'll ask an obvious question here, but why is this particularly dangerous for the left? Because as you mentioned, we see people in the Squad, we see many people in the Democratic Party cheering this on. So, I mean, how is this going to hurt the left, not just online in terms of censorship and deplatforming, but also in terms of direct action, you know, being able to exercise your civil liberties, your right to protest, your right to organize?
Well, every time the state gets these expanded powers, you just have to look historically who the U.S. national security state targets, whether it's domestically or abroad, and the answer across the board is the left. If you look initially at where a lot of what the groundwork for this war on domestic terror, where it was set up, it was done by the CIA in Vietnam, targeting supposed leftists or leftist sympathizers, and then that was taken by the CIA, used to set up Operation Condor in Latin America, where there were a lot of CIA military-backed dictatorships, where they similarly went up after the left. And the same is true also for efforts to infiltrate and destroy through programs like COINTELPRO, social and political movements in the U.S. in the 1960s and what have you. So, I mean, the fact that we're having progressives cheer this on shows, in a sense, either an ignorance or a decision to choose to forget about that history and how it tends to affect those types of social movements. And what's interesting is a lot of these domestic terror bills, while they talk about far-right extremism and things like that, the ACLU has pointed out that those laws would be used or most likely to be used to target minorities, environmental activists, and generally speaking, activist causes that are generally associated with the progressive left.
We've heard people say that the U.S. does not need more laws against terrorism. It already has enough. They say they're just not being enforced properly. So what is your take on that? Do you think the laws designed to prevent terrorism are already plentiful, or do you think they're just not being enforced enough? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, I think there's plenty of laws already on the books, and I think that is definitely true. What they're trying to do here is they're trying to be able to add federal terror offenses to things, to certain things, including things that aren't necessarily considered crimes in the United States. So now after January 6th, we're being told that basically occupying a federally owned building is going to be treated, we can presume from the language being used in the legislation being put out there, an act of domestic terrorism. If you think about it, that would essentially criminalize the practice of sit-in style protests, which of course have been fundamental to activist movements throughout history, the civil rights movement being an obvious example that a lot of people know about. Sit-ins were very instrumental in affecting change in that case. So to criminalize that type of activity is very dangerous, and people really need to stop coming at this from such an emotionally charged space and think about the consequences of this, because the establishment clearly doesn't want us sitting down and thinking about how the logical consequences of where these things will go. They want us to impulsively get behind these pushes for expansion of the national security state without really thinking about it.
So they're calling what happened at the Capitol a coup. A lot of the lawmakers, the media, they're saying it was a full-blown attempt to overthrow the U.S. government. How do you see that in regards to many of the things you just mentioned, where the U.S. Overthrows other governments, assassinates leaders, launches full-blown CIA programs to subvert the governments of other countries? I mean, do you think they're throwing that term around lightly, or perhaps trying to exaggerate what happened and play on people's emotions?
I definitely think so. I think they're playing on the fact that most Americans are completely ignorant of the actual coup attempts that have happened in history that have largely been done by the U.S. government or U.S. intelligence in countries abroad, and the consequences of those coup attempts and how they actually play out. I mean, the death toll from January 6th is extremely low for, you know, something like a CIA-backed coup attempt in places like Chile in 1973. Or something like that. So I really don't agree with that language. And I think the only way that characterization is sticking is because a lot of people just don't know the history or the fact that, you know, we do, the U.S. government has done coup attempts abroad for decades and decades and decades.
Right. They're deplatforming Trump from every social media site, even TikTok.
Or Pinterest.
I'm wondering, going forward, how is this going to affect the left? Because while people are cheering on for Nazis and white supremacists and Trump to be banned, okay, great. But we've seen how in the past, how leftists, foreigners, anti-imperialist outlets have also been banned, like Press TV or Telesur. So, I mean, shouldn't leftists be concerned about what's happening? Shouldn't we oppose private corporations interfering in public discourse and speech?
Right, absolutely. And I think some people have been had, if they think that Silicon Valley is on their side, So, yeah, Silicon Valley backs the DNC to an extent, and they're backing the Biden administration, obviously, over the opposition. But it's worth pointing out that Silicon Valley has fused with the national security state. Former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, is running the modernization policy, not just for the U.S. military, but for the U.S. intelligence community through something he chairs called the National Security Commission on AI, that is stuffed with Silicon Valley representatives. The U.S. military's Defense Innovation Unit for most of 2020 was run by a Silicon Valley executive, not a member of the military, even though it's part of the military. And a lot of these Silicon Valley firms, were Google included, were originally started with money from InQtel, which is the CIA's venture capital firm. And a lot of these companies double as contractors to the U.S. military or to U.S. intelligence. So to really treat them as just a solely private entity at this point, I think, is actually misguided. We really need to treat them as basically an extension of the U.S. national security state that with a lot of these companies ended up creating them. And so at that point, when you realize the line, how the line has blurred between Silicon Valley and the government, it really becomes state censorship. And to think that wouldn't be used against people of any political movement is very naive, especially when you consider that perhaps for now, this war on domestic terror, the boogeymen are people on the far right, but they've set it up so that there is now the Antifa boogeymen that it will be used to target people on the left whenever convenient for the establishment, and they will switch it whenever they see fit. And the people that are feeling oppressed now by this expansion will be like, yeah, those are the real terrorists, Antifa, and then we'll be cheering it on the other side. I mean, it's textbook divide and conquer, and if we don't see through this ruse quickly, the United States is in very deep trouble.
What do you think is the antidote? How can we mitigate this in terms of working class movements, leftists, anti-imperialists? What can we do not just to oppose these potential new domestic terror laws, but this unholy alliance between big tech and the national security state?
Well, I think we need to realize that our enemy isn't the person with the wrong lawn sign or necessarily a MAGA hat that's just around us in our communities. This is a class war, ultimately, what's going on right now, which is really the elite trying to create this giant neo-feudal underclass. And what we're having is this fusion of major private companies like Silicon Valley, for example, with the state that a lot of leftists would define as corporatism, and that is something that the Biden administration fundamentally represents. And so, you know, our enemy aren't our neighbors and things like that. And because of the economic crisis and all of this stuff, we need our communities more than ever, and we need to keep in mind who the real enemy is in a lot of cases, and who is really responsible for a lot of the suffering that's going on right now, both in the U.S. and abroad, and really keep our eye on that we are being played. Who is dividing and conquering us? Who is benefiting from this scenario? We need to start asking those questions and taking a look at who's pulling the strings of all of this and who's set to benefit. Because if we don't do something now, this war on domestic terror apparatus is going to be so pervasive and very difficult it will make it very difficult to organize in the future. And so really the time to do that is now. And that may, you know, require reaching across the aisle to people we don't necessarily agree with, but the leftist billionaires and the right-wing billionaires at the top are all working together against us. So it's about time that people, you know, in the class that they see as, you know, this giant underclass, that we start working together to, you know, stop this system from being implemented.
Now, last week, Donald Trump was impeached again, becoming the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. The first time in 2019, he was impeached over the phone call he made to the Ukrainian president, and now, supposedly, over high crimes and misdemeanors. In both cases, the articles of impeachment introduced by the House never included Trump's violations of the Emoluments Clause and Trump profiting while in office, receiving foreign dignitaries at his privately owned hotels on a regular basis, or even making his own military take pit stops to stay at his private resorts in Scotland. The articles of impeachment never included anything about the wars of aggression, about Trump continuing to support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen, or his acts of terrorism against Iran and Venezuela and other countries. If they really wanted to, the Democrats could have impeached him from day one for violating his oath to office and the Constitution. However, now all of a sudden, Democrats are animate and up in arms and have spent the last week railing about how Trump is an existential threat and democracy is under attack and the republic is imperiled. Quick, we have to get rid of him, they say. And yet, they did nothing for years. The U.S. political establishment is completely fine with white supremacy, fascist coups, insurrections, as long as they advance the goal of their empire and make a lot of money for them and their friends in the private sector. This is the harsh reality that many have yet to grasp. But for the rest of the world, this has always been obvious. And that very building where these riots took place, the U.S. Capitol, has always represented imperialism, oppression, war, and destruction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. We are going to discuss an important question in this episode, and that is, what is the philosophy behind the bitter and horrific events? Of course, each one of us might have come across such events. We may have experienced pain, we may have experienced bitter and horrific incidents in our life. Not only every individual, but also their families, their relatives might have witnessed such incidents in other people's lives also. To begin with, I would say that horrific and bitter events that occur in our lives are of two kinds: those that emanate from our own actions. We are ourselves responsible because of our deeds, because of our actions, and because of the decisions that we make in our life, so we are directly responsible for those actions. And of course, those that are beyond our control, there are some incidents taking place in our life that we have nothing and no means to control. Of course, they fall beyond our control. Like, for example, floods are there, you see, earthquakes are there, cyclones are there, and these are the things which we have nothing to say about. Of course, we have no say in them, so they are beyond our control. Many terrible events occur because of a lack of prudence and proper management, that is for sure. If, for example, during a transaction we fail to maintain documentation, and the other party, for example, fails to deliver the money, it is our fault. If we do not build a safety fence around a swimming pool and a child drowns in it, it is our fault, you know. If we do not practice good hygiene, if we do not obey road laws and follow special etiquettes, it's our fault. If we fall ill, have car accidents, or are humiliated in society, the fault lies with us. So these are some examples of the bitter events and horrific events that take place in our life when we ourselves are, for example, involved and guilty, and we are blameworthy, because it is that through our actions that we cause such bitter incidents in our life. For example, a driver who is reckless, who is careless, he weaves through traffic. He, of course, he does not pay attention to the road, or maybe he cuts other people off, or maybe he does not pay attention to the traffic signal and he causes an accident, or he is responsible for a fatal accident, he is to blame, not God. Or, for example, when someone conducts a transaction and he does not maintain documentation. For example, God in the Holy Quran says, when you want to, for example, carry out a transaction, then of course you have to present witnesses, or you have to call someone to bear witness. But we do not do this, and we try to trust the other person, and at the end of the day, that person betrays you. That person betrays us. So we are responsible, because at the end of the day, we do not have any document, any evidence, any piece of evidence to prove to the court and to establish our case or to win the case. That is our fault. And if we fall ill, okay, if we fall ill, it is because we do not observe the hygiene, or we do not take care of hygiene. If we let's say catch virus, especially in these days when we have this COVID-19, this global pandemic, we are not only risking our life, we are not causing only putting ourselves in danger, but also endanger the lives of other people. So we are to blame.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The second type of the horrific events, or the horrific and bitter events and incidents, pain, struggle, hardship are the keys to success in life. In order to advance, develop, grow, and overcome the difficulties of life, one must endure hardships, you know. Hardships make us more adamant, more powerful to tackle, to appreciate the blessings of Allah, and to understand God's blessings. The difficulties, hardships, and trials and tribulations in life can be the atonement of our slip-ups, our mistakes, and our errors. And they can help people adjust themselves to different settings, to different situations. The Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said, لَوْلَا ثَلَاثٌ فِي إِبْنِ آدَمَ مَا تَأْتَى رَسَهُ شَيْءٌ الْمَرَضُ وَالْمَوْتُ وَالْفَقْرُ. Were it not for three things, the son of Adam would not bow his head: death, illness, and poverty. So Adam would be ignorant, the son of Adam would remain ignorant, stubborn, and he would not bow his head, except that death, illness, and poverty make him actually bow his head. So this hadith actually suggests that hardships, bitter experiences, and tragic events, they are a blessing in disguise. For example, if there is flood, if there is a deluge,